Yeah, so my name is John Anderton. I'm currently a member of the Shoreline Ward in the Shoreline Stake, and I'm a recent discoverer of Sunstone, and I feel fortunate to have been involved in helping plan this in a small way. I also feel fortunate to be living in a time when traditional and non-traditional Latter-day Saints come together in an environment of mutual respect like this and share personal faith journeys. So moving to our next topic, a growing number of LDS families don't fit the traditional mold. Our panelists, whom I'll introduce shortly, are going to discuss how they approach their departures from tradition and navigate script variations such as divorce, single parenthood, child rearing, and LGBT issues, as well as how they map out new family traditions. So our first panelist I'm going to introduce is Lee White. He's a father and steward of four exceptional beings, and the grandfather and sub-steward of eight unique grandchildren. I love how he phrased that. He's the regional vice president for AARP and has worked in gerontology for 36 years. Lee teaches adult gospel doctrine in Sunday school in the Bothell Second Wards. I've been looking forward to meeting Lee not only because two of his daughters are close friends of ours, my wife and I, but because I also really enjoyed the Mormon Stories podcast on non-traditional families he participated in. Was that maybe a year ago?
Yeah, last year around this time. Yeah.
It was great. To his left, Amy Heffernan is the daughter of Lee, whom I just introduced. She's a marriage and family therapist in Redmond, specializing in couples, addiction, addiction, family illness, and sexuality. She recently had her first child, along with her husband, Scott, who's over there. I will independently add that I think she and her husband, Scott, are wonderful people, and my wife and I value their friendship very much. To my left, Tracy McKay is an adult convert of the LDS to the LDS Church, a single parent of three, and writes about her adventures at By Common Consent, Mormon Mommy Wars, and her own personal blog, Dandelion Mama. For those of you who haven't read her Dandelion blog, Tracy lays it all out there, which I admire. I encourage you to all visit her blog, starting with the post about life with her son Bean at Costco.
Oh my goodness.
Quite the adventure. At the end, we have Diana Nielsen. She lives with Katie, her partner of 12 years, and their daughter Bailey. Diana was active in the LDS Church for 40 years, serving a mission and in various callings. Diana has also had past experiences with Sunstone, I believe at symposiums like this. She now attends a Reconciling United Methodist Church with a really good church choir. Speaking of choirs, Diana's daughter Bailey and my daughter Ella sing in the Seattle Children's Choir together. Finally, we have Sally Grigg, who was raised, I have an expanded bio I was just handed, was raised on a farm in northern Utah and attended Utah State University, where she graduated with a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in theater and English. She moved to Boise, Idaho with her first husband and worked for the Boise Police Department in the Research and Development Unit, writing grants, public information materials, and training documents. She worked with her second husband in his family business, Silver Bow Honey Company, and they have three children. She's now a paralegal for a bankruptcy trustee and has various interests, including writing short fiction and poetry. So returning to the theme of our panel, each panelist, we're going to ask them to discuss how they approach their departures from tradition in what will hopefully be five wonderfully unique stories of 5 to 10 minutes each. Audience should feel free to interject where they feel appropriate with questions or asking for clarification on a point. And then at the end, we'll open it up again for kind of broader questions. I have some questions as well, but hopefully we'll get some audience interaction because I'm going to run out. So with that, why don't we start with Sally. She was introduced last, and we'll proceed from her to Diana, then Tracy, then Lee and Amy. Does that work? Okay. accept.
Yeah, I just said to Diana, I definitely don't want to go first.
Oh.
No, that's okay. I would say, never say things like that. Well, there's a couple of kind of scripts. I was thinking maybe most of people were thinking like a play script or a movie script or some type of like that type of script, or off a traditional script or a set script. But so I was sitting in front of my computer at the office the other day doing a little query in a module in the software I use all the time. All of a sudden, as I clicked print, it comes up with this message, one of those messages everyone loves. An error has occurred in the script on this page. Line 1570, blah, blah, blah. What do you want to do next? Or would you like to continue? Yes, no. Well, let's see. If you say no, you know it's going to shut down. And if you say yes, the same message keeps appearing. So to me, that kind of indicative of what happened when my 23-year-old son just one night says, I'm gay. Well, there's sort of a moment of, what did he just say? My unique situation was that I already knew gays and lesbians through my life, and often was a bit perturbed because I felt they were too maligned, because one of them had been my professor at Utah State and actually quite a mentor to me, showing great sensitivity and help many times, not to mention great talent and inspiration. But as I sat there that night talking with Aaron, as I talked to him many times before, after saying, run that by me again, are you sure? It's like suddenly you're in this wind shear. Part of you, you know, you're just being torn one way or the next. But after about a 2-hour discussion with him, the only thing in my mind was, and I told him, I have great fear for you. I want to be able to protect you. But that was the thing that I went away with that night. I have great fear for you. And then he waited a few more days before he told me, indeed, on his mission, he had had a knife to his throat and had sat there with it in his hand. He said, the only thing that had kept him from slitting his throat that night was that he knew I loved him. He did not want the image of me crying at his funeral. I told him how much I appreciated that, because he is indeed a joy in my life. His sisters don't always say that because he's a great tease, but he's a great joy in their life too, and my husband's. So from that initial thing came a journey. And I would say that every parent of every gay child goes along a similar journey. And at some point along that journey, you have to say, do you want to continue with this particular error in this script? Do you want to say, yes, I want to continue on the script and have it time after time after time bring up that same error message, which is what I felt happened with me in dealing with the church? Or do you want to say, no, I don't want to continue. The program shuts down, and you may try to fiddle with it, but are you going to go try to find line 1570? And besides, you're not the programmer. Somebody else is programming it. There's really no way to change it. I simply get new software, or don't use that module, and use everything else. That probably is more the type of thing I did. I simply did not use that module. But I used a lot of the things I learned growing up, born LDS. I call my mom's family hardcore. I call my dad's family pragmatic. But I guess the key thing is that, and it's hard to explain the journey. You can talk to people and you know where they are in their journey simply because of what they're questioning, what they're deciding. And I would say that there's usually two ways you can go with variations, because each of us, this happens to, and our children that are involved, you start down a path, and many times the paths of parents parallel one another, but you definitely go in one of two different directions. You go to staying active, you go to consulting church authorities, and you may even send your child to Evergreen or some other change therapy, because at that point, and this is my perspective having gone through what I did, to me, it's all about you if you do that. It's all about the parent if you try to change your child instead of understand him. You have to understand my perspective. There are others who don't think that way, but I do. And I don't think it's, I didn't think it was right at the time, and maybe it's because I knew people. Because one of the, after reading church materials, I mean, for 2 years, reading, talking to people I knew, one of them, I did go back to Sid Perks, who was at one time after I left Utah State, head of the department. And I said to him, if it's not a choice, and he said, Andy, it isn't. And certainly that's the conclusion I came to right away. Because here's the one thing. If I knew my son, we'd always talk. We'd always share, you know, as I did with all my children. I knew him. That's why I believed him. It's that simple. Either you believe your child or you don't. Either you believe the church or you don't. And ultimately, you do have a choice. You say, I reject this, I accept this. And I was not going to sacrifice my son on any altar. I was not going to have him go to those therapies. He did get his degree in psychology, but hasn't used it much. He found other employment during school, and that's what he does now. But there was a lot of research. And I kept researching, and I think that you talk about watershed moments. I'd say Prop 8 was absolutely a watershed moment for me. It's not a matter of being angry. I was truly disappointed in the church's behavior. And I know there are those who, I've heard all of the rationalizations, but I was truly disappointed. You know, this is a lot of history to give in 5 minutes. You better go ding. Because, but the way I have now, that error page just doesn't come up. I feel like I'm headed the direction. Culturally, I do charitable things. I donate to what in Grant County and Moses Lake is called New Hope for abused women. Humane shelter. I mean, that's the kind of person I am. And certainly you learn that as part of your LDS culture. You also learn a lot of things. That type of cultural thing has not left me. But other cultural things, and a lot of it is cultural. Hinckley himself in December of 94, right after that tsunami, actually said to Larry King, he says, well, what is it? What is the church? And he says, well, it's a culture. I was a little disappointed at that answer too, but I thought, isn't it more than that? You know, I'm floating out here. But much of it I keep, and some of it I have discarded because I want my son alive.
Sally, you mentioned scripts, mm-hmm, at the beginning, and I kind of get a sense from the outside that there are certain scripts that the church has, how they want these issues dealt with. What I'm hearing you saying is you've had to kind of pick and choose where within those scripts you've tried to deal with and how you've dealt with the situation.
Well, I try to deal with the traditional church script. You know, and there were many, many parents who sent their children to reparative or change therapy, whatever you want to call it. Not having been myself, I had, and never having sent my son, or he would never have agreed to go because he was, like I said, 23. But I heard from others that I've talked to, one person on a chat group that I'm in said that she felt raped by the questions she was asked and by how she was talked to. So, my son was too much like me to really care, although he did say that he would have liked to have gone up in testimony meeting and said various things. Telling everyone it was all fake and then run out crying.
Have you found, there's been a couple of events, I think, happen recently that suggest that perhaps the church's scripts are changing somewhat?
So no, they're
parsing
words.
We know sometimes it happens at kind of a glacial pace, but example, when President Packer's recent talk was edited post-General Conference, and then there have been some purported changes in the new church handbook of instructions, which come out,
yes,
I believe,
I've
today.
Read those too.
What does that do for you personally? Hope or does it discouragement?
A lot of people have a lot of hope because they see a change. But what it is, it's parsing of words, eliminating some, but the key thing is still there.
Okay.
And to me, I was a feminist in the 70s too. I mean, I kissed the church goodbye twice now. Activity. So it was the same thing, you know. They throw you a few bones. If you love it, I'm sorry. But, you know, they let us pray in sacrament meeting, which we'd never been done before, and they let us, you know, have our endowment if we were single or married to a non-member, and a few little things like that, and then they whip us up into working against the ERA. So I've been through this before, and watching the words, the parsing, the legalese, we can take this word out, we can still kind of mean the same thing. Sure, they say, no, we don't want to kill you anymore, you know. But you can be second class along with the women, is my feeling. And I see it as a backing off, is what I see it as. And because to me, women, gays, whatever, really have no standing to really make the changes we want. And so, as Orson Scott Card said, I think in an article in Sunstone, he said, if you don't like it, leave it. And I says, hey, already have.
Your son Aaron, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's, how old is he today?
He is 32.
So this has been about nine years since he...
Yeah,
okay.
Since he came out.
So maybe some open wounds there. I was going to ask Diana, to your left, she also is dealing with, you know, dealt with some of the same issues. So I was wondering if you maybe had what perspective you could bring to the table on this, having been separated from the church, I think, for quite a longer period, and maybe share with, and not to cut you off, Sally, just
that's
to,
okay.
I think maybe together it could be a little synergistic, the conversation. Do you mind sharing with us your background?
If I could, that's loud. If I could weave that answer into my
that'd be helpful.
Into my broader issues. I'll back up just a little bit. As I was approaching my 40th birthday, after having been an active member, however, a Sunstone member, having served a mission, having been a Relief Society president as a single person, approaching 40 put me into a terrible spiritual crisis. I had been promised in my patriarchal blessing that I would be married and have children. On my mission, before and after my mission, I was promised that I would be married and have children. And since that had not occurred in my life, the only answer to that was, I'm not worthy enough. I haven't done enough. I haven't been good enough to receive that blessing. My friends were married, had children. Our conversations were about giving birth, which I hadn't done, raising those children, which I hadn't done. And I was angry. I was angry. And I was not sure where to go at that point. What I was told by a variety of well-meaning people in the church was that I was too picky. I had dated a lot of men, a lot of good men, and now I'm not going to deal with the issue of how gay am I or not. There's a scale, we all know that, and I'm somewhere more in the middle than perhaps some people at one end or the other. So when I decided that I needed to take a sabbatical from the church, I did so with the blessing of my bishop, Gary London, who's a wonderful man, a Sandstone member. I'm sorry he's not here. And I spent about a year trying to figure out what my church life would be. What I missed was a church choir, so I found one. Very good church choir, and then I realized that if you go to the rehearsals, eventually you are going to sing in church. And that was a Methodist church, and I knew nothing about Methodist churches. But I found that this was a reconciling Methodist church, which means it was a safe haven for gays and lesbians. And in fact, a lot of the leadership was gay and lesbian, and I was quite stunned by that. And there were wonderful lesbian couples and gay couples, and they had, some of them even had families. And this was about 17 years ago now, 16 years ago. And I settled into the choir. I learned how to walk down an aisle singing hymns with a hymn book, which is a really different thing for a Mormon. And eventually, I met my partner, Katie, there. And I learned right away that Katie wanted to have children. And I had put that away in my life. I was 45 at that point and felt way too old to have children. Plus, I knew that having children put you out. And coming out was an excruciating thing with my family, my LDS family. And that's a different story as well, but I knew they had told me that they really hoped I wouldn't be unreasonable enough to think that I should be allowed or able to have children. So that was a difficult time, and my partner Katie is extremely persistent. And we moved forward for, spent 2 years with her trying to get pregnant through artificial insemination. 17 attempts, thousands of dollars, heartbreak after heartbreak. And finally she decided that what she wanted was a baby and she could give up a pregnancy. So the story of getting our daughter is also very miraculous that I don't have time for, but we adopted her directly from the hospital. She was born at 28 weeks, a pound and a half. She was in the hospital for 2.5 months. And I just want to say at this point that I now know many gays and lesbians and gays who have adopted children. And we often are the ones who are in the position of taking the most vulnerable children. which is, can be a tremendous amount of work, but one which we choose to do for our incredible hunger and desire to have family. So the couple that had agreed to adopt, Dutchie Bailey was a twin. She had a twin sister that died at 6 weeks in the hospital. She was smaller than Bailey. The couple who had planned to adopt them withdrew because of their premature birth. And so we came on the scene, fell in love with this beautiful, tiny, tiny baby who was about 4 pounds at the time. And our family began. What I would say is that here in Seattle, the support for gay and lesbian adoption is very big. People bend over backwards for us and still find that huge support. I know it's not that way in a lot of places. So I was still on the rolls of the church at the time, and home teachers kept popping up and visiting teachers, and I would explain to them, you know, I have a partner, and their reactions were usually rather quiet on the other end of the phone. And then when we moved to Shoreline, some old friends of mine from my university second ward had themselves assigned as home teacher and visiting teacher. And there began the process of my excommunication. He was the state president, and their befriending of us was lovely, and yet it was increasingly uncomfortable as the elephant in the room kept getting bigger and bigger. And I finally said, I don't want home teaching anymore. And so he said, well, then I'd like you to talk to the bishop. So I met with the bishop, lovely man. We had a very honest, open conversation. And his final response to me was, you need to leave your partner. And I looked at him and said, you want me to split up my family? My family? Why is that okay? I know he was heartbroken about that as well. That was his only option as my bishop. And so the excommunication went forward, which I will now say was a blessing. I was ready to be done with the conflict. And so we are our threesome. I would say one of the things, well, you should know my family is not very different from your families. Katie fulfills the dad role, and it just kind of happened that way, and that's the way Bailey has seen it. I'm the mom role. We both do a lot of the same things. We both parent her equally, but when it comes to when she's hurting, sad, and scared, she comes to me. When she needs to face a tough problem or situation or math, she goes to Katie. She's a very, very balanced little human being. And other than some learning disabilities and some school challenges, some attention deficit issues, some phobias based on her time in the NICU, she's remarkable. The research shows that children who grow up in a two-mom household do better in school and are very well-adjusted children. And there was a question I was supposed to answer.
No, I think that's great.
Okay.
Yeah, Ella thinks Bailey's wonderful. I wanted to throw that in there. I guess I'm interested at this point in how you think your faith, your discussions on faith and spirituality and God with Bailey have changed, or how they compare and contrast before, you how you looked at it before. And Ms. Sally, you could maybe jump in on that one as well, and that might be a good segue into the other three panelists. And
this is a challenge for gay LGBT Mormons when they leave the church. What we have open to us is liberal progressive religion, which in many ways can be deeply unsatisfying to a Mormon. The churches are extremely political, and it becomes a dominant factor. So when you live a life that's very hot politically, and you go to a church that's, there's not the kind of spiritual relief and nurturance that I would like. And I struggle with that. Thank goodness for my choir. That's a deep part of my spirituality, my religion. When it comes to my daughter, I am conflicted. I very much want for her to have a deep faith in God. I want her to know the wonder and the awe of the Creator. And yet she's in a religious context that is not what I would want for her. There's not a lot of support for family structure. And so it's difficult for LGBT families to find the support, the nurturance, the structure that gives you strength for the long haul.
Sally, do you have anything to add to that?
I do. I'm thinking first. I'm not trying to get as wound up as I did earlier.
You're fine.
Maybe it's growing up on a farm amongst nature. Maybe it's my paternal family who found their spirituality not in a church. Because my grandparents, I lived in their basement for 12 years, and I loved them both dearly. They were enormously busy, hardworking, give the shirt off their back kind of people, but you wouldn't catch them in the church house. But my mother's family was hardworking people who were always there. But I go at it. I think there's a difference between spiritual and religious, and I've been through phases where I wasn't too fond of organized religion in particular. And I'd say today that our family just loves each other. And I have things I feel spiritual about, mostly wide open solitary spaces and nature, and with my son, it's superheroes, so. And gaming, so that's where he finds that's fine. But that's it. We talk about mostly that we just love each other, and although my children have differences and their stepsister and stepbrother, I think that, and I know wonderful people everywhere. Sometimes when they get involved in a liberal or a conservative script, it may actually override their own wonderful personalities. So my boss is one of the best people I know, and he is, he and his wife are just very faithful and do everything, and, but they're more than that. They're more than that, so.
Just add one more thing, too. I still draw on a lot of my my Mormon grounding in spirituality. And the closest thing I have found to that is Benedictine monastic spirituality. I spent a lot of time in spiritual retreats in Benedictine retreat houses. I find real depth and strength there, and I bring that into my life. My family, we pray a lot. Bailey understands prayer. We kind of struggle with how to use scripture. But she goes to Sunday school every Sunday. I used to be the Sunday school coordinator. Once a Mormon, always a Mormon. And so I do my best to provide her spiritual grounding, a structure of community for service, and a good choir.
Great.
Well, song is her spirituality.
If this wasn't my first time moderating, I might come up with a better way to segue. But I'd like to move to Tracy. I think it's the issues that were just discussed are top of mind. I consider it the issue of my generation. I think discussion is helpful. So maybe we could loop around back to it at the end. But Tracy, why don't we move to you, and you can kind of share your situation.
Okay. My story is substantially different, but, you know, once a Mormon, always a Mormon. I come in to the same, well, very similar place of standing from a completely different journey. And I'm going to pretty much scrap everything I'm prepared to say because it really isn't terribly pertinent now. I'm an adult convert. I joined the church 9 years ago. And in a way, I think that gives me an advantage because I came in from a very liberal family background. I came in with 5 gay members of my family. I came in from a mother who told me when I joined the Mormon church that I could not be her daughter anymore. So I experienced a lot of the same things, or similar things, just in a, you know, in a different color, that other people have experienced that got them to where they're at. In a way, I think it gives me an advantage because I don't have the generational baggage of feeling that pressure of having to work these things out, because I worked out my position with my family when my mom told me I couldn't be her daughter anymore. And I started from the get-go of my testimony as a Latter-day Saint to be able to sort through, sift, parse, and figure out what worked for me and throw the rest out. And I don't have any problem whatsoever doing that. It's interesting to me that I would be labeled an alternative LDS family. I'm a white woman in the West. I'm divorced. That's my alternative credo. You know, how it came about, I have a son with a disability. I have a son who's autistic. I had already partially worked out, and I agree with your point of view that the gay and lesbian issue, especially with regards to the church, is one of the key issues of our generation and our time. I had already worked out my own comfort level with my family members and with where I was at, and like I said, I'm completely fine because of my awareness of our history, of tossing out whatever I find that doesn't work for me, because I know our doctrine and our rules change. I know it. And so I'm okay with it. But there was a kind of watershed moment for me personally when one of my sons decided a few years ago that he was going to dress as a girl. Now, my sons are young. They're 7 and 9. And I pretty much just rolled with it. I didn't really care. He wore Mary Jane shoes and tutus to church. I have pictures of it. I decided not to make a big deal out of it. I thought, well, you know, if he wants to, he wants to. And I had to deal with the blowback in my own ward of people who just found that absolutely reprehensible that I would allow my son. And I'm thinking, this is a small boy. What about this threatens you? And I had trouble with my own husband, who's now my ex-husband, but that's another story. And the kicker for me came the day that I found my son in his sister's closet, hiding in the closet, dressed in her clothing. And I opened the closet door and I stood there and I just looked at him. And he was hiding. And I just broke down in tears. And I sat down on the floor, Indian style, with him in the closet. And I said, you do not ever have to hide. You don't ever have, I mean, the obvious symbolism was ridiculous, but it was, you know, like being smacked upside the head. This child is never going to feel like he has to hide in our family. He is never going to feel like he has to hide in church. And that was when I started letting him wear girl clothes all the time. And for two years, he did. He dressed as a girl. My bishop had a little chat with me about it. But for me, it was one of those sifting moments where I'm going to sort out here what works for me and my family, and I'm going to side with my child and my family above any sort of policy. And it's a pretty easy decision to make when you look at it that way. He doesn't dress as a girl anymore, but if he did, it wouldn't make any difference. I also went through, I've been divorced for about a year now. When I joined the church, my husband was not a member. He did join after I did. Like I said, it's been 9 years. We went from having a very, very traditional, typical LDS life. You know, I stayed home, I gave up my career, I was raising my children. He was providing. We had all the earmarks of what looked like a successful LDS life, or just general American life. And then he got caught up in a cycle of addiction. And when I'm talking addiction, I'm talking hardcore narcotics. And in a period of 2.5 years, he caused us to lose both of our homes, our 401k, our entire savings, our good name, and everything we owned. And it's been an interesting sifting process for me as I've watched the reaction to people who tend to look at things very simplistically. If you were only then, if you were only more faithful, if you were only more prayerful, if you had only done this right. Well, I did everything I was supposed to do. I did everything right. And it doesn't take away the agency of anyone else. It doesn't take away anyone else's decisions or who they are. And so I found myself again in this interesting position in my ward. And I am active, and you know, I got a testimony and nobody's ever taken it from me. It's been interesting to watch as I've morphed from you know, Martha Stewart Jr. in my church culture to now I'm the single woman in the ward, and I live in a very conservative area. I don't live in Seattle. And it's been interesting for me to watch as I go from being that person who was, while in my own way, marching to my own drummer, but I was still looking like I belonged, now to being outside having my face pressed against the window. And I, you know, again, I'm really okay with it, but it's been interesting. And it makes me want to plant my flag and say, you know what, I own this. I joined this church by choice. This is my faith. This is my, and it really makes absolutely no difference to me what the policies may or may not be in the current climate, because I know who I am and I know what I believe. And I have no problem getting up and walking out of Relief Society if somebody gets out their drum and starts beating on what a mother should be. I have no problem during Prop 8 getting up and walking out of sacrament meeting. And those are the ways I show where I stand. And I know everybody has to decide for themselves where that is.
And I mean, you do have a very unique family and situation. And sometimes that can be, like you said, difficult within the church. Where have you found hope? Like, is it, have you had to really look inside your own family and maybe certain things your kids do? Or do you see it at all? Where have you found it within the church? With a certain leader or?
No. I wouldn't say there's been any one particular leader. It's been more about just minding my own heart and my own spirit and being willing to trust what I know to be right for me and for my children and for my family. And, you know, I've had these very serious talks with my children about if so-and-so says something to you about this, you know, here's what you can say, here's what you can stand. I'm militantly defendant of my children and our family. And, you know, I'd throw myself on a pyre if someone suggested that my son go to Evergreen. It just wouldn't, over my dead body. You know, he is who he is, and nobody can take my faith from me when I choose to plant my stake there.
That's great. I think those are inspiring words. So, Lee, moving to you, you probably have had your daughters wear tutus and Mary Jane's to church, and it's been perfectly okay. You have, what, three daughters and a son?
Three daughters and a son.
Why don't you share with us your story?
My story is very different from the three previous panelists. In fact, as I look at the context for this panel discussion, I'm about as on script as probably any of the five of us. But I still think there's enough of a story behind my life and a message behind my life that I think might appeal to those of you who are struggling Latter-day Saints, who are raising children and trying to help them figure out how to deal with the ambiguity, the contradictions, and the gray areas that continue to impose themselves on us and the way we define ourselves, among other things, as Latter-day Saints in an increasingly complicated world. I grew up in probably one of the most sanitized places in the world, Bountiful, Utah. And there wasn't much diversity of people, diversity of thought, diversity of experience in Bountiful, Utah. So I grew up in a very traditional Mormon home. The Whites and the Williams and the Craycrofts of my family joined the church between the early 1840s and the 1860s in England, and found themselves in the Great Basin in the 1860s and 1870s, up through the turn of the 20th century, the early part of the 20th century, and were faithful, believing people. And that's what I entered in 1951 when I was born. But I wasn't terribly aware. I grew up in that environment and accepted most of the cultural mores and norms that were imposed on me as a young kid growing up in a Latter-day Saint family with his father as the bishop, with four brothers and sisters, going to Bountiful High School. And the only person of color in my high school was a black kid who had blue eyes. And that wasn't very diverse. During my mid-teen years, I disaffected from the church, not because I had this profound sense of religious disconnect with it, but just because I was spiritually and emotionally lazy, and it didn't appeal to me. I was bored, and because of that, I engaged in what I consider to be the normal range of mischievous behavior for a kid in his mid-late teens. All right, it was on the very, very far left fringes of mischief, and with one episode, when I was 15, nearly 16 years old, my mother came to me and said, not in a reprimanding way, not in a way where she was grounding me or chastising me for my inappropriate behaviors. All she said was, who are you? Where does this come from? Because that's not how you were raised. And it got me really thinking from that moment on to this very moment about self-definition. Who am I? What is my reason for being? And how do my behaviors and my actions on a day-to-day basis reflect the essence of who I am and the beliefs that I have? And so I started a quest at that time to try to define myself, and had a conversion experience. I gained a deep sense that I was a son of God, and that carried certain expectations with it. I found myself really gravitating toward believing in Christ, and that made sense to me. It spoke to me logically and emotionally, and I became a believer in the mission and purpose of Jesus Christ. I also gained this sense of self-definition from those early experiences. But I also learned from my parents that all the while I needed to be questioning. And a vital part of that questioning is doubting, seeking, remaining in the question on occasions when the church as a thought partner and a belief partner seems to fail me or offers contradictions to how that belief system or that credo begins to form. I had some powerful influencers in my early adult life. Lowell Bunyan was the director of the Institute of Religion at the University of Utah, and he was evicted from that position. He was fired from that position for his stance on the black and the priesthood. And I had conversations with him before I went on a mission for the church in 1970 about his stance, and his position on that made sense to me. And I wrestled with that my entire mission in my Japan mission. And my mission was a wonderful, fulfilling experience, but I got more out of it than the church probably intended for me to gain. I got exposed to Zen Buddhism and found that to be a wonderful thought companion for me at that time. And I've remained a student of Zen, not necessarily a practicing Zen Buddhist since then, but clearly a student of the philosophy and some of the precepts and constructs that are found in Zen, and find them to be a wonderful complement for some of the beliefs and the constructs that I find in my faith in Mormonism that help me strive to be a better person, try to be more complete, try to renew myself around concepts of repentance and forgiveness and atonement. That's important to me. As I contemplated becoming a parent, I thought, how do I choose to be a parent? How do I choose to bring these children into a world that seems to try to seduce people away from self-definition and self-thought and self-analysis and self-awareness? And so I went back to some of those people who had influenced me, and they helped me realize that in spite of all of the seemingly strong contradictions and ambiguity that might exist within the faith of my childhood and the faith that I have adopted as an adult, Mormonism, I can continue to wrestle with the questions that remain in my life. Who am I? What is my reason for being? And how do my behaviors and my actions on a day-to-day basis act as a true testament and an authentic statement about who I am? It's taken me to some wonderful places, but some places that seem on the surface to at least look like I'm going off script. As recently as this past August, I was asked to perform the wedding ceremony without authority, I might add, so I don't make too much of a big deal out of that, but it's my daughter's best friend and her partner getting married in just outside of Portland, Oregon. And I led off by quoting Gandhi about civil disobedience. Well, this marriage ceremony is being performed without authority and in a state that doesn't recognize gay marriages. So on so many counts, we could have been perceived as violating the law. But I prayed about that, and the Spirit bore witness to me that that was not only okay, I was compelled to do that because of my love for these two wonderful people and their love for my daughter and her love for them. And I found no contradictions in my faith with that at all. Now, did I make that an issue with my bishop or he with me? No, it didn't come up. In fact, one could argue I'm kind of a chicken. I didn't bother to talk to him about it. and my fellow ward members are held to secrecy on this. Thank you, Thomas.
So that's a little unorthodox, right? But on some of the, I've heard through the grapevine that on other things that it may be a little unorthodox, you're not shy in the ward, things like that, on
right.
voicing your opinions.
Right.
How have you been able to become comfortable in a ward structure, kind of standing out a little bit?
I have to sort it out and make a distinction between the formal sorting out and the informal sorting out. The formal relates to my current calling or any calling that I might have. I am a gospel doctrine teacher for adults, and I don't feel like I can go off script with that because I have people in that class who are seeking affirmation when they attend church on a regular basis. So I look over the lesson manual material, and I make sure that the constructs that are being emphasized in that lesson are underscored as I present the material. I take liberties with it. So I'm quoting from the Quran, the Talmud, the Torah, in addition to the Old Testament. Current topic is Old Testament, but I don't limit it to that. I go to Buddhist scripture and Hindu scripture and occasionally Nietzsche to underscore a certain point. That which does not kill us makes us stronger, right?
So you mentioned earlier, who am I, right?
Right.
I guess I would argue that part of who you are is Amy.
Yes.
Since she's your daughter. Why don't we move to her and kind of get her thoughts on...
Yeah. I'll keep it short.
What was it like being raised by this?
Yeah. I always tease that I was raised by a Zen woman. That's what I always would call it, and people kind of don't understand. And it was funny at the wedding that you performed when people would find out that we were Mormon, it was like... they were speechless, really. They're like, a Mormon man just performed your best friend's wedding.
Where do you guys stand on Prop 8?
Yeah. And it's just breaking the molds, you know? And I think that was one of the biggest lessons that I learned from both my parents. My mom was a typescript or whatever. I don't know what they call it. They probably don't even have that job anymore. She typed the document. What was it, Mom?
Editorial assistant extraordinaire.
Yeah. On the Mormon Enigma book about Emma Hale Smith. And so I was raised in a culture where I didn't even need to ask the question because the questions were being fed to me. And I teased that my sister older than me, she got all the faith, and I got like none of the faith. So her letters home from her mission were very faith-promoting and very much the church is true kind of stuff. And mine was like, they're brainwashing me. Why are they telling me that I don't have enough faith when I'm in Japan and I'm proselyting in a Buddhist country, you know? And so there's a spectrum even from the same parents when you have a whole bunch, you have four different kids and they're all gonna turn out a little bit different. So I guess I'm just here to say that sometimes non-traditional parenting can turn out okay, maybe, hopefully. Now I'm a therapist and I want to specialize in sex therapy, and that also shocks people. I say Mormons have sex too, you know, hopefully. And
yeah. All evidence to
exactly.
validating that point.
Yeah, so that's basically me.
So you mentioned that questions and maybe some sticky, difficult issues were fed to you. I guess that brings up the concept of inoculation. Which is sort of this concept where we feed, it's gaining popularity, we feed our children certain, you know, topics in the hope that, yeah, well, they may get sick, hopefully they don't die from the disease later without the inoculation. How do you feel? Because obviously you were inoculated to some extent from difficult church history issues and other things. How did that affect you on your mission? How did that affect you now as a new mom?
I think it made me open to more people throughout my life. I think there's been times when it's been harder to be me and be a Mormon and kind of fitting the mold, like the script that we've been talking about. Sometimes, like even when I was dating, I felt like there, no Mormon boy will love me. I am a Democrat, you know? or like when they meet my family and they know that like my mom is a strong feminist and was really mad that she couldn't bless my brother. Like when someone hears all this stuff about my family, no one's gonna want me, you know? And so kind of that like feeling unworthy a little bit of like, you know, maybe I don't deserve a Mormon boy, but I got one. He's really great. And he asked me this morning, why don't you go to more Flintstones when you're young looking for men? And I said, they're all old people. I was just like my parents' culture of Sunstone. So I think that it's nice to know. I think one thing I've learned is that you kind of can shake it out, and no matter in what ward, there's going to be people or friends kind of like you. You just kind of got to find them, you know.
I wanted to actually say something about inoculation. I'm a big proponent. I teach, or was teaching, the 12 and 13 year olds, and I had a dozen of them in my class. And I think this is, again, somewhere where didn't grow up Mormon, so I don't know what the hot button topics are. And I have a lot of friends that are historians and really well-read and really generous with sharing their information. So in my 12 and 13 year old Sunday school class, one Sunday, we were talking about, I don't even know how it came up, but we ended up talking about polygamy. And I just let it all out. I started talking about, somebody said something about Brigham Young, and then I said something about when Joseph's wives, and the class was silent, and a couple of the children put their hands up. Joseph only had one wife, he had Emma, and I said, no, that's not true. And I went right into Nauvoo, I started talking about, and I handled it in such a matter-of-fact way with them that afterwards we had this incredibly charged and interesting discussion with these young teens. And when I got home, I emailed Jonathan Stapley and Aaron Brown and you know, half of my friends at BCC, and I said, what did I just do? I'm waiting for the phone to ring all night. You know, the parents are going to start calling me. But by the next Sunday, I had people coming up. I had the kids thanking me. I had parents thanking me. And I think it was because it was handled in a completely matter-of-fact, no big deal way. It wasn't, this is some secret. This is, yeah, it happened. It's part of our history. Big deal.
Someone with good intentions.
Yeah, there was no, I had no agenda. It was right. Just, well, yeah, Joseph had a lot of wives. Which ones do you want to talk about?
Yeah.
Does the church not teach that anymore?
No.
The history of polygamy?
No.
Really?
Well, not in an official capacity to 12-year-olds.
In some classes, they do.
The church does not teach church history and gospel doctrine, or we teach doctrine and covenants. So that might be what we don't talk about.
But I've raised the issue of polygynous relationships and the church's cultural history with that in my Sunday school class. We've had rich discussions about it, and I've never had anybody in the bishopric or... I guess there's still Sunday school presidencies operating, other than they do more than push the button to let you know that the class is over. And no one's ever come to me to say, you were off message, or we want you to protect the members of the class from that information. I want to just say one more thing about inoculation, because I think a lot of times, in my experience, there's a bit of an edge when we talk about going up against a belief structure in the church. If you are talking with your children about this is my experience and it contradicts what the mainstream message in the church is, that can create some cognitive dissonance. And I'm not saying we haven't had those kinds of discussions with Amy and her sisters and brother, but more often than not, it ends up being somewhat of a more irreverent examination of part of that culture. Singing is just a part of that, but it's a vital part of it. I'm inspired by a lot of the Latter-day Saint hymns, but there are some that don't speak to me. So my kids know that anytime Called to Serve gets sung in a sacrament meeting, I look over at them and say, okay, this time couples only. Because when I grew up in Bountiful, the Bountiful roller skating rink occasionally had an organ music playing, and it was John Philip Sousa marches, and they would say, okay, single women only. And then on the next round, they'd go off the floor, and it would be children under the age of 18. So when I would hear, call to serve, it sounded to me like the Bountiful roller skating rink. So I would lean over to my kids and say, okay, couples only. When they would come home from primary and sing primary songs to me, Most of them were inspiring and made sense to me. There's one, Follow the Prophet, that sounds more like a Halloween song to me. So there have been occasions with my kids and now my grandkids where we put on Halloween masks and it's Follow the Prophet, follow the... Okay, that's irreverent and maybe even blasphemous and sacrilegious. But part of it for me is helping create norms where you can laugh at yourself and you can recognize if we're going to adopt this institution as a thought partner and an influence in our lives, then let's look at the whole package and recognize that this isn't completely ideal, that there are some things that we can push back on and not have a fear of the organization coming at us in an over-the-top way to sanction our behaviors or our observations of faith.
Can I just, I know we're out of time.
And then,
I
and then pass it to Diana. And audience, feel free to jump in at this point.
So there's been times when I'm stuck in that, like, I have to be black or white in the church. And it's in times, like, I remember when I was home from my mission, I was attending a singles ward, and I couldn't relate at all to people getting up and saying, you know, like, Jesus is my best friend, things like that. And I was, like, thinking, I don't fit here anymore, you know? And I remember calling up my dad and just saying, I don't know what to do because I may be done. I may be thrown in the towel on this one. And he just says, Amy, why do you think you have to live in the black or white? You know, and there's gray, and I like to say there's a rainbow, and I can live in that, and it's okay. And so I've really had to come to work to, like, find a place for me in the tapestry of the church. And I think that my dad's helped me facilitate that without, like, we have different opinions about certain issues, and we talk about that, you know. And so I just think it's nice that he gave me a place to say, to be able to say that, to say, like, there's
this. I don't believe that. Yeah.
Yeah. Where I think as parents, it's kind of hard to say, like, what do I do raising a kid when they get information at church and then they come home and I want to say, well, that, you know, that's crap, you know. And so how do you create a place like that to not brainwash your kids either in your thinking too? So.
Can I make a comment?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Give me the microphone.
Close. I'm Romana, or Romana Anep, if you want to find my writer's page. Quoting Trevor Southey, I am the odd duck. Started using that term. I am the T in LGBT. My wife helped me transform myself to look this way. But it's coming to an end December 1st because of outside influences. So we won't be the LDS really odd couple anymore. And so if you want more information, you can talk to me afterwards. I'm still restricted going to my wife's ward dressed this way. The bishop just couldn't bring himself to allow it. No other church I go to has a dress code.
Thank you.
That's another whole topic that needs discussion, certainly. What I wanted to add to that about inoculation or indoctrination, the biggest challenge I have with my LDS family, I have one sister who remains in the church, and she has 6 children and a zillion grandchildren now. A few years back, the daughter that I am closest to, who lived with me for a few years, who left the church when she got married a few years ago in North Carolina, I had planned to come to the wedding with my daughter, and my nephew determined that his children couldn't be around my daughter. And so my sister had the horrible task of telling me I couldn't come. Now, if you can imagine how excruciating that is, that my little precious daughter is somehow going to hurt his children, somehow is going to bring up something so horrible to them that, you know, they would somehow be damaged. That is a real defining point for me. And what I had to say back was, I can't have your children around my daughter. Because I will not have anyone tell her she's not good enough. Now, you know, as parents and moms, when your child is insulted, you get really mad. really mad. And I began to think how, why? Why do decent people come up with that opinion that their children can be involved with our children? Is it contagious? Is being with my daughter going to make them gay? Are they going to ask uncomfortable questions to their mom and dad? Why does she have two moms? You know, then my nephew has to say, well, she's bad, evil, you know, whatever, all those things you come up with to explain your aunt who is gay, and that's not okay. When a gay Mormon comes out, or anybody comes out, your whole family has to come out of the closet. And that's a very, very, very painful thing to religious family members. I've had to work long and hard to understand how difficult it is for them to come out of the closet as well. On the other hand, it makes me angry that the church has isolated itself so much from the rest of the world and the reality of our lives, and why that indoctrination needs to be so, they won't call it hateful, but we look at it as hateful.
Well, hopefully discussions like this will lead, I guess, both sides. It'll be less painful coming out of the future. So.
Well, there are, of course, many wonderful LDS people who are supporting. I understand the fear behind the church's need to keep this boundary straight.
Any question over here?
My question's for Diana. How have you felt that your relationship with God has changed since you said that you pull some things from your Mormon experience, and you kind of interweave that with your how you're teaching your daughter and maybe your relationship with your partner, but how do you feel like kind of a middleman has been removed and it's just you and God now, and how do you feel he feels about you and you feel about him and giving your experience?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking that, because when I left the church, I did feel like I needed to get the middleman out of the picture, that I wanted a direct relationship with God. I wanted a direct encounter. I wanted the judgments out of the way. I wanted that condemning God out of my life. I needed to know the loving God. And as all gay Christians, all great gay Christians have to go through the process of having a direct confirmation from God that you are loved. Mine was extremely powerful. And it's been the rock for me since then, and the rock that I share with other gay Christians, that absolute need to know of your love, your being loved and accepted by God.
Any more questions? A couple more, and then when we wrap it up for a break.
This is for Lee. Follow the Prophet. I used to be primary music leader in my ward, and Follow the Prophet didn't strike me as Halloween-y or spooky. It struck me as an Israeli folk song. So when I taught this song to my kids, I taught them how to dance the hora. Yeah. We did it, you know, with the temple. So it became like this light, fun thing, like, yay, Follow the Prophet, not a threatening thing.
That's a better approach.
Your question, sir?
I just have one comment. My wife grew up Catholic, and she said one of the things she loved about the church was that she gave up that idea of a threatening, vengeful God. and accepted a concept of a loving God that's taught by the church.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thought.
Hey, John, I just have a question.
Yeah.
For Diana. Diana, if things were different with the church, you know, with regard to their position on gays and lesbians, would you be a member of the church then, or would you come back, or are you okay where you are now?
Woo, that is a question I have not found myself thinking about.
I don't know. I really don't know. If my family, I got a call once from some fundraisers at BYU. It was the family living people, and I said, you know, I have a same-sex partner. When you can accept my family as equal to all other families, I would consider contributing. And she was really cute. She said, I have some gay friends.
They all say
that. Yeah. And I thought, okay, there I've said it. I don't, it's hard to think theoretically because I don't see it ever happening in the church. Do I wish I had the church for my family to gain strength by? I don't know. I guess now that I've been away, I am dissatisfied with other points of doctrine as well. So I think the answer might be no, but I don't know. Thanks for bringing that tough one up.
Yeah, why don't we end on that? I guess on that note, I just had something pop into my head just to end on. I would hope that if that policy changed, that even if our lesbian and gay brothers and sisters didn't return to the church, that the church membership would flip a switch and would be able to put their arms around that and be welcoming back of people. I think that would be just as important.
You'd have a lot of great organists coming back to the church.
We'd like to thank the panel today. That the wonderful points of view from each of them, wonderful stories, and I think we'll end on that note. Mary Ellen.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Great story. Oh.